to imagine all life as you know it stopping instantaneously and every molecule in your body exploding at the speed of light.
Total protonic reversal.
Protonic reversal.
Protonic reversal with your host, Conan Neutron. Broadcasting from a secret underground lair in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
A gigantic middle finger to everything that is rock about music, rock and roll, and corporate power.
The thing is, though, if you don't laugh, you're going to go on a killing spree with sharp and nails.
Confidence of a hero or a fool, I wasn't exactly certain which.
Could not be more professional.
It means something.
And they got away.
You know, that's my take. What's yours?
Protonic reversal!
That's like a science thing, right?
Indeed it is. It is a science thing. It is a science place. It is a scientific fact that we're all up in your faces. Time once again for the one, the only... Protonic Reversal. Welcome to it. Episode 422. Missed the wee number by two, unfortunately. Very excited shortly to be talking to Mr. Brian Giles, Red Fang, Party Time, Last of the Juanitas, all great bands. And we're going to be speaking to him about the brand new release, 20 years as a band. So fantastic. It's great. I'm jamming it all weekend. Week and weekend, sure. Everything's a weekend. Every day is the weekend if you live your life right. Am I right? Anyway, before we do that, welcome to Conan Neutron's Protonic Reversal. I am your host, Conan Neutron. I'm a rock and roll lifer who's been touring and recording for 25 years, most known for the band Conan Neutron's Secret Friends. I'm a rock and roll lifer that's been touring and recording for 25 years. So I think about that sometimes. Music is a huge part of my life, and I use the format of this very long-running podcast to talk about music with musicians whose work I enjoy and respect, but who may not be household names. This is episode 422. Now, if this is your first time listening to the show, archives of it are available for free. No ads, no sponsors, no kidding at protonicreversal.com. However, if you want to support the show and get episodes sooner, $1 a month at patreon.com/protonicreversal will achieve that goal. And if you like the show or even just a single episode, please feel free to like, subscribe on your platform of choice, share it around the internet, or even leave a review. All that helps people discover the show. It beats back the almighty algorithmic overlords, and it's just a darn nice thing to do. A big day today for me. Very busy. Because, of course, today is also the release, digitally on Bandcamp, of Way of the Neutron, Conan Neutron, The Secret Friends, new record. If you want to hear me sing and play guitar, Tony Ash play bass, and Dale Cover play drums, there's a lot of awesome rocks and riffs that are on this. Neutronfriends.bandcamp.com. Go get it. And if you happen to be in Japan, we're playing Japan for 2 weeks, coming up on the April 1st to April 12th. So that's why this is going to be the last episode of the show for a few weeks. I'm going to be busy playing the rock and roll, which is the thing that I do. All right. But before I do any of that, Brian Giles. I was just talking before we went on air about how big of a fan of The Last of the Juanitas I was, and Party Time, and also Red Fang, who have a new record, which is great. And it's a monster in the best possible sense of the term. Very excited to talk to this fella, Mr. Brian Giles. Let's bring him on right now. Brian, how
Hello.
You doing?
Hi.
Dude, congrats. For some reason, and this, I guess, I'm showing my age here. I'm like, I still think of Red Fang as a new band. It's like, oh, yeah, 20 years. Jesus Christ. I guess it's not that new.
Time flies.
But, like, then I thought about, like, all of the records that you put out, all these badass records, and how consistently road dogging you guys have been over the years. And I was like, oh, yeah, it kind of makes sense. This is a really neat collection. It's like a bunch of like non-album tracks, singles, B-sides. There's some like demos and stuff that's in here. I always love those kinds of releases, and I think this is well representative of the band, but also kind of shows the crazier stuff as well. How long did it take to put all this stuff together? Was this like a years in the making project or what?
It did take a long time, it seems. we started talking about doing this about a year and a half ago. So, so I'm surprised that it's out too. But yeah, it's a cool thing, and there's a lot of weird oddities, you know. And you know, you were saying how you're a fan of these things. I'm not.
All right, real talk. I just don't
care for them in general. I'm like, well, if it wasn't good enough to be on a record, then why am I listening to it now?
I gotta say, you're quite the salesman. But
I know. I'm the worst advocate for anything. But no, but that said, I listened to it when I got the record, the vinyl, and I wanted to listen to how the mastering sounded on vinyl. And and I was pleasantly surprised at how evenly the mastering job was done. They did a really great job because some of the stuff is like, they're from a bunch of different studios over 15, 20 years. And some of them are, you know, I did some of this stuff on like GarageBand. So
right.
I was like, how is the GarageBand, you know, basement tapes going to stand up against, you know, a professional production? And I think it turned out great. And listening to it, and maybe I'm, not objective, but it really didn't feel like one of these sort of
tossed off
junk drawer type
right.
things. It's like, you know, that's pretty good. I mean, like, I didn't doze off, you know. I was like, okay, that's cool. And I think the way that it's paced is good. I'm happy with it. And I don't think that it really comes off like that. If we weren't telling you that it was, you know, junk drawer, I don't think people would say, what's this garbage? I really don't.
Totally, because there's no like ill-advised reggae jams or like, you know, some kind of just like, what are they? What is this? Like, when did they record this? It all seems like it fits well together. And yeah, I would notice the fidelity as well, because when you're dealing with stuff that's all over the place, you know, how do you get it to not sound, you know, like a nightmare listening station malfunction, you know, where everything is just like going at the same time and like, what's happening? You have to have it be a listening experience. But I think it actually works really well as a record. It's just kind of, if you're familiar with the band, you might be like, that's interesting. Like, what's that? Like, that's, I didn't expect that. And I think that that's, you know, if you're a fan, that's kind of cool. And I think one of the big giveaways is the demo version of Wires. But it's also really neat to hear it like that, which is like, oh, wow. It's like simultaneously all there, but completely different at the same time. Like, that's just kind of neat to see if you know and love that song. So
yeah, it's, you know, and just that, well, I don't, this is probably too nerdy, whatever, but this.
No, there's no such thing on this show. No way.
Well,
keep going.
Well, just that. It's just kind of, it's a little off-putting to me, the hits. There's, you know, it basically, you know, does the verse, and then it breaks up the verse with these, you know, bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
And there's only three in the demo instead of four, and I'm like, ah. It's
and like you're used to hearing it one way.
Skipping. I know, exactly. I've heard it the other way thousands of times, so it's a little like,
yeah.
Yeah. But it is cool to hear the you know, the germ of that song, you know.
Well, and I feel like I became such a curmudgeon of, don't give me your demos, give me your completed tracks and your completed record, and that's what I'll listen to. I don't really care about your demos for so long that I think I kind of went back around and be like, all right, maybe I'm being like a salty grump about this. Maybe it is kind of interesting to hear it. That said,
maybe that's what's wrong with me.
I mean, look, game recognized game is all I got to say, where it's just, you know, but it is, there is something kind of cool. And this is obviously not what this release is, but I'm thinking about like those, did you ever hear the Funhouse sessions that they released, where it's like all of the recordings of Funhouse that like, you know, including the ones that weren't used, which is worth listening to one time. At least
okay.
once, you know, and you're like, well, oh yeah,
I do want to. Well, now I want to hear it. I mean, is it? But it's actually different recordings.
The arrangements are like, you know, they're clearly working it out as they're going. Like it's interesting to hear, like especially for someone that's you know, written a lot of songs and made a lot of records. It's kind of fascinating. But am I going to throw it on a Saturday afternoon? Fuck no, I'm not. Are you kidding me? But it's,
yeah,
but it,
I mean,
serves that purpose.
Yeah, for a songwriter, from a songwriting perspective, it's kind of nice to hear songs that you know you feel like are perfectly arranged, and then to hear what screws were loose and how they tightened it down, and then you can say, oh, okay, yeah, you really didn't need, you know, 16 bars of that, and they tightened it up. That was a good choice, and just, you know, and also it's helpful in realizing that even your heroes, you know, like, you know, Stooges are amazing, but it's like, but they're human beings too, and they had to go through the same process that all the rest of us do.
Yeah, like that goes on a little bit, don't you think? You know, in the wrong way. Yeah, exactly. And that's, I think that's always fascinating. I think it would be a different story if this Deep Cuts release was just all of those. It wouldn't make it uninteresting. It would just be something that maybe have less repeat listenability for someone such as myself. But I think it's cool because you have that, like, that really killer Wipers cover that you guys have done. Like, I saw you do with Jason from Gaytheist.
Oh, yeah. What was that? You were up in Portland for that? I think we only did that once.
Just the one. I mean, but I know the Gaytheist dudes from way back when, too.
I've been playing music with Nick. And it's been fun.
What was Nick? What was the band he used to be in?
Well, he's in what is it? Great Falls.
He's been in Great Falls for a while, and I think we played with Great Falls when he was in the band. But he was in God, I can't remember. This is like the least scintillating thing I could possibly do on air. But anyway, great. I've known that guy for a long time. Like I remember when he threw in with those guys for sure, because he was a big guy. He's a friend of Carly's. I know him as a friend of Carly Henry. Anyway, whatever. Nobody cares. Okay. Moving on.
Yeah, he's an amazing drummer.
He's a great drummer. Yeah.
If you all haven't heard Gaytheist or Great Falls, you should check him out.
Gaytheist, new record out too.
Yes.
New record out like real recently that I need to actually get a copy of. But we're playing with him in June, so maybe I'll just wait till I see him.
How cool.
So. How much? Because there's a lot of stuff on here. There's a lot of songs. How much of it was just like, oh, it'd be cool to have that be like a proper release, and how much of it was like, all right, like here's some weird stuff, you know? And I'm thinking of the Two Boy Army cover, which I love Two Boy Army, and I remember when I heard you guys had covered Two Boy Army, I'm like, what, for real? That's awesome. let me listen to that. But I feel like, I don't remember what it was on, but I feel like it like took a little effort to find it for whatever reason at the time.
Yeah, I don't remember how that came out. If it came out, I don't even know. Why we did it, I don't know. Well, I mean, whatever, it's cool. And then we finished that and went on a tour pretty hot on the heels of its release, wherever that was. And and Two Boy Army was touring. They were playing the same clubs we were, like a week ahead or a week behind.
Are you kidding me? That's amazing.
I was like, Gary Newman's going to beat me up.
But what a story that would be, huh?
Yeah. Great.
Oh, wow. Giles got his ass kicked by Gary Newman.
Exactly.
Really, really weird. No, but that always struck me as interesting, too, because, you know, just knowing... you know, Juanita's and to a lesser extent, Shiny Beast, and like where everyone was coming from beforehand. I mean, you know, I was lucky enough to see Party Time play good amount, which is sort of like definitely the joiner band between Juanita's and Red Fang. I felt like it was sort of like, oh, you can kind of see the embers of maybe what is to come with it. But I always felt like you guys had a really cool kind of grounded sense of like, no, these are just like kick-ass songs and we're just going to do kick-ass songs. And it isn't, it happens to be put through the funnel of how we all play together rather than we are going to try to do this thing and play this sound. It kind of developed naturally is what it seemed like to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think Party Time and Red Fang both really didn't have any kind of overarching philosophy like, oh, we're going to be a heavy metal goth band or something, you know.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, it's not a terrible mission statement.
I mean,
but
yeah.
It's always been just, hey man, does this riff or, you know, this thing, you know, inspire you? If everybody in the room is inspired, then that's what we sound like because we're all willing to do it.
Yeah. Aaron, who was on the show some years back, 3 or 4 years ago, I can't remember exactly when it was, but he mentioned that a common theme was Brian would come in with like a super cool riff and then be like, okay, don't play the last like 2 or 3 parts of that. Like, just like keep, like in the kind of keep it simple category of don't prog it out too hard. And that usually ended up working well. And I think that's fascinating.
Well, Party Time was definitely a kind of, there was no self-editing button. I think it was just like, oh, what about this part? What about this part? I mean, yeah. Some of them have like, we just recently did about 2 years ago, we did a reunion.
Oh, did you really?
Going back to, yeah. And
how did I know about that? Weird.
Well, it wasn't widely advertised, but we did one in Seattle and one up in Portland. And anyway, going back to those tapes and learning them, I was like, Jesus Christ, another iteration of this? What? How many different ways can we? Jesus, I'm fucking exhausted. Anyway, right. I'm, you know, so yeah, I think that, it, you know, the similar riff writing from Party Time, but I think that once it, you know, we boil it down a lot harder for Red Fang, it's not quite so like epic, like 19 part punk songs, you know.
Yeah, where it's not like, oh, this is like King Crimson, but you know, the hyper aggressive stuff, like
on meth. Yes, exactly.
Right, exactly. On, it always has to be on something. Yeah, on meth, on crack. Okay, fine. You know, yeah,
on tape.
On, there you go, perfect. Well, and I mentioned because I feel like I may not have the same experience that a lot of people have with Red Fang, and the fact that I was a huge Last of the Juanitas fan. You know, so, and it's something that I'm very, very proud of saying. I saw you guys play in San Francisco a lot, and including in somebody's kitchen in Oakland, which was a rarefied air and experience during the Time's Up record. And I was always like, why isn't this band more popular? Why isn't this band more like well known, even amongst like the kind of nerds that it's for? And I felt like it wasn't that you guys were unknown, but it was one of those things where it's like, I just feel like this band is, you know, can't catch a break for whatever reason.
Well, I feel like having, it's been a couple of years, but the last time I listened to it, I think my overreaching impression was these songs are not done. Like just listening to my stuff, I'm like, okay, I can see where I was at and in the riff or whatever, and then sort of like got exhausted. I could hear myself being exhausted, like I didn't go the extra mile there. Like if I could go back and redo that shit now, I would do more or something. I don't know, but I mean, but I loved it. But and the reason I think it didn't go anywhere is because it was almost purposefully not inviting. You know, it didn't right. really want you to come along. It was like, we're going here, and we don't give a shit if you're following it or not. You know,
yeah,
it's crazy,
and it's willfully oblique almost. Right? and for me, that was an asset. You know, that's great. That's like, oh, great. That's extremely for me.
But, and the 8 other people in San Francisco.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But what I was about to say is you'll never run a career successfully catering to my sensibilities. There's no way. It's just not going to happen.
Right. Yeah, but, it's just like, you know, as a genre, like, you know, opaque, really alienating music. I don't know. I don't have a lot of that in my record collection.
Exactly. Well, I will. So, 2 things. I will say, one of the biggest shows that Replicator played, which was doing support for Trans Am at Great American Music Hall, I made a special point of wearing my Last of the Juanitas shirt for all 3 people that noticed or cared. That's
yes.
So that was the kind of loyalty that band engendered. But There just wasn't.
Well, I appreciate
enough of us.
It. No. Hey, man, we got a tank of gas and orange whips for everybody. So right. It worked.
It's a couple slices of pizza, exactly.
Exactly.
Well, and then, but I feel like there was an evolution as much with Party Time, where I remember the show that I threw with you guys in the crazy former opium den in San Francisco with Big Business. And it was like you had to go downstairs. The whole place is like a death trap waiting to happen. But they would just let anything happen there. So it was Party Time and Big Business. And that was my first experience with Party Time, where I was like, oh, it's kind of like a little more like approaching classic rock or something, which little did I know, but it was different. It hit differently. And I was like, oh, that's interesting to see him be like that. And of course, it was something where, I don't feel like that band, from my perspective, I didn't really get the chance to hang with that band that much, but it was around for a couple of years, right? Party Time.
Yeah. We did a couple of West Coast tours. Never put out a record. You can't find it anywhere. You might find it on YouTube, like live show or something, but, yeah, and you know what? I think you're right. There are some moments that are like, Grand Funk or something,
Yeah.
Kind of jammed into a lots of extra BPMs, but it is that,
Right.
I think we were just like, fuck it. Well, we called it Party Time, so we're like, there's no rules, no parents, no rules, man.
And that was my first experience seeing John Sherman too. I was like, oh wow, that guy's no joke, right? And I assume whenever you have a mutual admiration society with Cody Willis, that the drummer is going to be great. But that was my first time in person seeing it. But it occurred to me how much it had, like there was an intensity and a vitality to it, even though it kind of seemed like maybe it wasn't a fully formed ethos or anything, but it was like, oh no, this is just a kick-ass rock band. Awesome. Very, very cool. And then I remember Josh Vanek from Vantage USA hooked me up with the EP, the first EP of Red Fang.
Oh, and yeah.
The CD. I still have these CDs, by the way, probably about 20 feet that way. But do I have a CD player? Not really, but... and then I was like, oh, wow, this is interesting, because for me, it kind of seemed like you're like, hey, let's take everything that was cool about these bands, distill it down and just make really, by comparison, concise, kick-ass rock songs, just really boom, out of the gate.
Yeah. Red Fang is way more verse, chorus, bridge band,
So I'd be interested in hearing from your perspective, because I talked to Aaron about it. Did you have like a sort of, magic moment of like, oh wow, this is really cooking, where it all kind of came together, or was more of a gradual upswing towards that early, very early Red Fang stuff?
we had no experience with some kind of success. So, whatever, we were just like, yeah, well, let's play music. We've always done it. We'll keep doing it. And to have people respond in a positive way was a little shocking. Yeah. And I guess probably when Aaron did the vocal track for Prehistoric Dog with Adam, I think we did that at, what the fuck was that studio called? Shit. The dude who does tape op, fuck. Jackpot.
Jackpot. Larry Crane. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, Larry Crane. Anyway, Adam Pike recorded some of those songs there, or at least the basic tracks were there, and then I think we finished a lot of the stuff at his basement. But I remember Aaron putting the vocal track on that, because we had a demo of that song with me singing, and ugh, not good. So... It really wasn't. As a matter of fact, there was a burned CD version of it at a bar here in town, and John stopped in there for a beer, and it started playing, and then it was that version. He freaked out and went home and got a new version and went down there that day and was like, "You've got to remove that CD. Here's a new one." So anyway, but
wow.
It really wasn't good. It's just me going, rah, 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 so
yeah.
and it was not melodic, and it really was like sounded like Cookie Monster having a bad day. but when Aaron put that track down and we listened back to it, we all had a sort of a feeling about it. We're like, damn, that's actually a good rock song. Shocking that we did that. Well, guys, we did that. That's crazy.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, I feel like sometimes you know and sometimes you don't, but sometimes it's like, oh wow, this is something. This is something pretty cool. And it's, you know, sometimes like, oh, I'm gonna be playing that for decades. You know, you don't think about that at the time, but you know, it's like, oh, that's good. Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, get used to it, buddy.
Yeah, hope you like it.
You are literally going to play this song 5,000 times.
You're gonna play it so often you'll be thinking about your laundry on stage. You know, but you know,
you know. But the thing about that is, if what I strongly believe is, you know, whatever, if you're making music so that you can, you know, put asses in seats, and you're just like, this is, you know, I'm doing this for financial success, then, well, beware, because you might succeed. And right. If you're making music that is catering to an audience, you know, and you don't believe in it, or it doesn't speak to you. You just know that it's accessible. And then now you're playing this garbage for 5,000 times. You're in hell. You might have, you know, a loaded bank account, but you are, it's
miserable.
It's floating in tears. So luckily it kind of landed, you know, squarely in aesthetically in my camp, and other people could relate to it. You know, I mean, it certainly didn't hurt that, you know, Whitey McConaughey made a really striking music video. He's made a really striking music video, and so the music, you know, was, I mean, there's some oddball aspects to that song, but it carries it's kind of like it's like a Kiss song or something, you know, but not that, but then so the music is accessible, and then the video, you can, you know, you can relate to us, because who doesn't, you know, like drinking beer and being knuckleheads? And so they're like, oh, these people are regular. And it's like, yeah, well, yes, welcome to Red Fang. We are regular as people.
You know, I, in high school, before I moved anywhere cool and got into music and whatnot, I definitely did my share of LARPing. You know, like, it's one of those things where it's like, when you try to find your people in a small town, you'll take whatever you can get, right? And I just remember being like, holy crap, what a great idea for a video. And then just be like, oh man, what a great video, because then it does the turn. And I firmly believe, and I'm not trying to blow smoke, it's what, like, if I was to be forced at gunpoint, I don't know who would do this, but if I was forced at gunpoint to make a top 20 music videos of all time, it's in there and in the top 5, if not the top.
Well, it's right on.
And that isn't to say that you guys haven't had other great videos. You have, like, you know, most of them are fantastic. Like, I, you know, that I've seen. And I say that as someone who's very critical of the genre. But that one, there's something very special about that time, that where the band was, and that song specifically, that seems to just, you know, some things echo throughout epochs of time. And I think that's one of them. And, you know, good on you for that. That's it's still
success. Yeah, I mean, it's great. You know, I think that having something that people can latch onto like that is, I don't think every band needs a music video or whatever, but it's like, if you have some way to reach across the, you know, huge sea of things out there, and there's tons of great music out there that no one's going to, you know, spend the time to discover or sit with, and you know, it's helpful. That's all I'm saying. And I don't think we'd be where we are today without it. So,
and you can have someone that maybe doesn't have like a pedigree or you know, a CV in heavy music, and they'd be like, hey, check out this hilarious video. It's awesome. And then they're, you know, then you get to get people that are maybe more casual, non-music obsessos. Their life hasn't been ruined and or saved by music, depending on the day. And they can connect with it.
Yeah, I don't spend all day looking at comments, but I remember back in the day looking at some comments, and more than once you would see something like, "This music video is amazing."
Yeah.
Dot dot dot. Music's not bad either. I'm like, what? I'm like, whatever, man.
Right, and you got to try not to hear the insult in that, right? You got to be like, all right, no, it's you know, fine. Like it's
I mean, they section. it's in their brain, so.
Yeah.
Suck it up, people.
You already won. Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
And it's so funny to have like a song hit like that so early on, right? It's almost like the only corollary I can really think like Touch Me, I'm Sick or something, right? Where it's like, oh, this is Mudhoney wrote their signature song and it's like one of the first things they ever did. You know, and it's like it's a song that
it's all downhill from here.
No, I mean it's just that like that's the one that like you can if that's your entry point, you're like, all right, cool, they sound like that, awesome, fantastic.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I mean sometimes people are like, why don't you write more songs like Prehistoric Dog? I'm like, well, no, we're not gonna do that. No,
because you've already done it, that's why.
Yeah, and we're way too ADD to be like, oh, let's just rehash that. It's like, no, I've got 9 more other ill-conceived ideas that I want to chase after, you know?
Well, and that's, I mean, not to skip ahead because I want to serve all the music and talk about it. Like, I thought Arrows was awesome. Like, Arrows was, like, rowdy, noisy. Like, you know, that was a killer record. And I was actually, you know, I was, like, pleasantly surprised. I was like, oh, they went kind of, like, deep in a different way on this one that like hit kind of different, and which was also well served by the, you know, the neon neon green eyes and whatnot. It was like, oh, okay, Arrows, there it is coming.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that the people complained about the production value on that record.
Really?
And yeah,
I love it
being muddled or whatever. And well, I mean, I think I'm one of the few people that doesn't give a shit about that. You know, I think about like for example, Samhain, November Coming Fire is mixed pretty fucked up.
Oh, it's garbage.
You know,
but I
love it, and I wouldn't have them do anything different. I would not have them remix that, remaster it, anything.
Yeah.
It's great. It's a flagpole of whatever. Talking about punk rock goth bands, I mean, that's if I could be in a punk rock goth band half as good as Samhain, I'd be happy. But in any case, I think that it's, to some degree, people couldn't see or hear past the production, and I think there's some great songs on that album.
I think it's awesome. It's like my second favorite record of you guys, so I guess I'm just, I don't know, I'm outside the I guess I'm outside the mainstream, even amongst Red Fang fans. So take of that what you will. But like, think of the first Gang of Four record. That record sounds weird as hell. If you stop and think about it, like what makes a good band recording? It sounds strange, like austere and like. But it wouldn't be the same if it was any other way, would it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think that ironically, I was talking with someone who is sort of an on again, off again Red Fang fan. But
Fair Weather Fang, thank you.
Well, hey-o. But they were, I was talking, I think it was like our record we did with Ross Robinson, Only Ghosts. Mm-hmm. And they were like, ugh, it's too fancy, it's too produced, it's too nice. I'm like,
yeah.
What the fuck? You know what I mean? You just make yourself go crazy trying to make everybody happy, you know, because they were like, oh, we want the raw, fucked up sounding, you know, first album, whatever. And I'm like, well, you know, bands progress. And so,
yeah, go listen
whatever.
To that. And then, what's stopping you?
And then, you know, we put out Arrows, and everyone's like, ah, what the production value. I'm like, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, you can't. Not only can you not please everybody, you can barely please anybody, so don't even try. Don't even worry about it.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. I mean, you still put your pants on and do stuff, but don't do it because you think everyone's going to be happy about it.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it's weird how that works, too. And also, you know, some records, they just, when they come out, people have opinions about it. Maybe those opinions change, and maybe people, like, rediscover it, or maybe, you know, people are like, oh, actually, you know, this is pretty cool, you know, or whatever. And And sometimes you go the other way too, which is a bummer, where it's like, oh, I thought this record was great, and it's only fine. You know, that's
yeah. I mean, some bands, I'm like, I cringe at the thought of them not being hyper produced, like Def Leppard. You know, I mean, holy shit, they're that fucking artificial sheen they put on everything is so bubblegum, but I love it.
It's perfect.
I'm like, ah, it's just listen to the shimmer. Everything has got this bullshit shimmer, and I'm like, whatever, man. It's super satisfying. It's like a I don't know. It's like a Hostess product.
Could you imagine? It never would have happened. But Def Leppard, like recorded by Steve Albini or something. Can you imagine? Like what would that even be? Like that would be like what? What is that?
I would be interested to hear it.
It doesn't sound bad. It was just like that would be like mind-breakingly different than what you're used to hearing.
Did you hear the remix of what is it, Holy Diver, I think, that Joe Barresi did?
No.
It's crazy. It's way more rock. It's it gets rid of that 80s thing. Everybody felt like that was what you had to put the cream filling or whatever, otherwise people weren't going to go for it, you know. Like you can hear them, like the click tracks and people talking in the background. It's way more those guys making that record, and it's pretty exciting. I love the original, but I'm like to hear kind of more of a dirtier, more honest version of it is pretty awesome. So yeah, if you haven't heard that, check it out.
Did you see that Dio documentary?
And Joe Barresi is the shit.
He's awesome. Yeah.
I mean, nobody, very few people will follow an engineer, but he's definitely someone to follow just the kind of headphone craziness that happens on his albums, like Asinine Animal or not.
Oh, yeah.
What's that? Or right.
You're thinking of
Soundgarden.
God, what is it called? I was listening to it the other day. Christ, I can't remember right
Crooked now. Steps is the hit off of it, or whatever, the single.
King Animal, right?
King Animal, yes.
Yeah, okay. Oh, Jesus, that was killing me.
Anyway, that's Joe Barresi, and I'm just like, man, just if you smoke some weed and put headphones on, it is you fall way deep into that thing.
Totally, and he's done, that guy's... That guy has a thing, and it's a good thing, but it's not like a square peg round hole thing.
He's got a really great ear, and he has a shitload of patience.
Yeah,
that's all I can think is like, man, you really dug into that. I don't. That's some. You know, I would 95% of human beings would definitely gloss over this, but he really, you know, he pays attention to even the smallest. Little, you know, pass notes and everything.
Hey, man, he got some of the best Oxbow records out of those guys, and that's no mean feat. You know, I was impressed. I was like, wow, Joe Barresi and Oxbow, crazy. Okay, it works. Right on.
Yeah.
Did you see the Dio documentary that came out a couple years ago?
No, I probably should.
It's
for
really-
my entertainment.
It's really good, but I mean, obviously, it's a little sad as well. But I highly recommend it, and I say that as like you know something of a casual fan, like just like I like the stuff I like, and it's worth watching. But it's kind of a drag. That's the only thing I'll say because it's like, oh, he deserved better, you know, like that's what you come away with it.
Oh, are we tuning up the violin for Dio?
I guess we are. Yeah, exactly.
I don't think so.
But it's also hilarious, like when he leaves Rainbow, because like he doesn't want to compromise and doesn't like want to write pop music, and then they have that huge hit like immediately afterwards, like with the next singer. You know what is it? Since you've been gone. That song they have it like immediately after he leaves. It's hilarious. I mean,
who was the singer after Dio?
That's a good trivia question.
I know we should have a trivia section. I've never been one of those people that's like, oh, the third guitar player for Ozzy or whatever. I'm like, nah,
not usually. Care. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I know. The
I don't have the brain space.
Right.
I can Google it. Should I Google it?
Yeah, now you got me. Let's see. Okay, I'm looking at the Wikipedia. Singer Graham Bonnet. All right. He includes Michael Schenker Group, Alcatraz with two Z's. Let's see.
You gotta have that extra Z.
Bonnet's visual style, considered uncharacteristic of hard rock musicians, has been described as being a cross between Don Johnson of Miami Vice and James Dean. Okay.
All right.
fair enough.
That's on his wiki?
That's on his Wikipedia page. And he's apparently was doing jingles for a while before joining Rainbow.
That was probably more lucrative than he could stay in his underwear.
Oh, man. I guess he was... when Brian Connolly left Sweet, I guess like they were trying to talk him into doing it, and then he went joined Rainbow instead. Okay, wild. Anyway, learned a bunch about that dude. Okay, great. No, but I think it's you're in a situation as a band too, where for a lot of people, it's like the minimum thing of like the record being the advertisement for the show, right? Like I'm gonna go to the Red Fang show and see a bunch of kick-ass Red Fang music. And then they're the nerds that are going to, like, sit there and analyze everything. Oh, well, I feel like the production here is, like, you can really hear the compression on the snare. Okay, sure. Uh-huh. Yep, fine.
Yeah.
But I feel like you guys have always been very true to yourselves about what you were trying to do at the time. And that includes expanding sort of the crayon box a little bit production-wise. And then also not writing exactly the same songs over again, you know. Bless them to death, but the Ramones are the Ramones, and not everyone needs to do the Johnny Ramone thing of just not play your guitar so you don't accidentally get better.
Yeah, I mean, there's bands that have found the sweet spot, and they stuck it, and they made a massive career, you know, like AC/DC.
Yeah.
They weren't breaking the mold from record to record, you know, but they're still distinct, and the songs are classic. I can probably sing an AC/DC song for you, you know, having not heard it for 10 years. They're just really well crafted songs, and you know, just a wide open A chord is really sometimes all you need.
And there's certain things that it's like it is kind of deceptively weird or crazy. Like if you listen to what Malcolm's doing Back in Black, it's like he plays the same chord like three different ways. You know, it's not just like dunderhead stuff. Like it's the minimalism of it is what, you know, makes it fantastic. And like what makes it like instantly kind of stick to your ribs level rock and roll.
Yeah, it's amazing. Have you heard this? I don't know. I haven't verified this, but supposedly Malcolm and his brother would tune their guitars something like 3 cents off of each other. Which is how apparently they got some of their magical zing.
Really?
That they are slightly out of tune.
And they always did that, or is that something they just kind of?
That's supposedly their technique, and that's what they've done. I don't know. Do you buy it?
I mean, in a way, like Angus especially is, you know, very smart, calculating dude for sure. But it also seems like. Maybe they just stumbled on it, like, hey, that sounds cool, let's do that. And like that, you know, both ways can be true. Like they ended up doing that, but it was just kind of, oh yeah, let's just keep doing that. That's good.
Yeah, they, I mean, they just seem like they're, you know, whiskey swilling, dick swinging guys, and you don't think they would be really thinking about their
actually, if you put it 3 cents above the, but yeah.
Hey, exactly. You just don't, that's not part of their mystique, you know.
Right.
But I think it's possible. I don't know. I believe it. Let's just say that.
Well, and that's interesting too, because then you think about the tricks of like Priest, right? Judas Priest, like they would like put like just the ever slightest amount of delay on the guitar, and just to give it like a little more heft, make it sound a little more beefy,
wider, yeah.
And it's something where it's like, and then you know what's the. What's the effect in metal music that most metal dudes would be like, ugh, and recoil like they were vampires? And it's, you know, unless it's like a specific kind of metal, it's going to be like delay. But it's like, oh, yeah, Priest used it though. So can't be that bad. It's all in how you use it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit. Someone was asking about your guitar, which I think was actually an interesting topic. As very the unique body style of your one guitar, man. That's the Mustang. The Mustang, yeah. The coolest, craziest looking. What happened to that guitar, Mustang?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I kind of retired it. I started playing a Nick Huber, but because that yellow guitar, the Mustang, it was lost in an airport somewhere, and so wouldn't have it for a weekend, and so I borrowed the Nick Huber from David, and then that was a mistake because I fell in love with it. So it was just really easy to play, and the neck is way easier to manage, but I do love that guitar. And I don't know what the deal was with it, but I rescued it from like a destroy everything house party. Mm-hmm. And I think that my assumption is that someone wanted a Les Paul Jr., but didn't have the finances for it. So they just got out the bandsaw and they,
I was going to say, but we
Mustang.
Do have a saw.
Right. So they made it look like a Shriner's car version of a Les Paul Jr. And I love that guitar. I mean, I played it for, I don't know, yeah, 20 years. And I finally looked it up. I had it refretted or something. And it's a 1964, August 1964, which was the first month they made Mustangs. And it was small scale. So it's worth a shitload of money if they hadn't done that. Currently worth nothing. It has lots of it has lots of sentimental value, but anyways, if they just left it alone, you could have probably put your kid through college.
Sure, those things are wild high priced. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but that's fun. But it's also kind of, it's distinctive. I mean, I can tell you exactly what it was. It was when you guys were on Letterman. And I heard somebody was like, yeah, it's awesome that they're up there doing their thing, doing their kick-ass heavy songs, and like all their stuff you could have gotten at a pawn shop like 20 years ago.
Yeah, we're not gearheads by any means. Sometimes we'll do rig rundowns, and I agree to do them, but I'm like, it's not going to be entertaining, And I'm like, well, here's my head, here's my speakers. Yeah. And then I plug into it, and I've got a tuner.
Right, exactly.
And people are like, it's bullshit, man. I'm like, it's not bullshit. Because the thing is, the less crap you have, the less can break. And that's my philosophy.
My guy, I'm right there with you. Yeah. that is a working man's application of gear of like, all right, what can fail here? And like, how can we not have that happen? Right. I mean,
cause you're going to find yourself playing a JCM 900 on some backline someday. And you're going to be real sad if you have a bunch of fancy shit that fails on you. So just go with what's, going to be there for you.
Did you gravitate towards the Sun stuff for like price consideration, or was there anyone that like when you were like, oh yeah, like that person uses that?
I think for Las Juanitas, I used a Fender Bassman 50.
That I remember very well. Yes.
Yeah. And that was like, it was souped up to some degree, and I would run both preamp channels on top of each other.
Yep.
And it was okay, but then I started playing with John Sherman, and immediately I was like, oh, I need more than 50 watts, because I couldn't hear myself. Yeah. So I started playing, I think, a Trainer 100 watt head, and then I sold that, I think, to Kevin from Face Down and Shit. Anyway, so I needed a loud amp, and then when I moved back up to Portland to start playing in Red Fang, Aaron had like three or four of those Sun heads already. And so it was loud enough.
Right.
And also I was like, shit, man, this amp sounds cool. And that's my sound is just turn the gain up to like nearly pegged. And, uh, and run both channels. And I think it was, yeah, it was just convenience is what did it. But early on, I think we realized that having all three stringed instruments playing the same model of amp really sort of congealed the sound, you know?
Yeah, like they, man. Yeah.
They work well together because the individual instruments, they definitely have their own character, but mm-hmm. they're all in the same section of the rock library, you know?
Well, and that's, it's so funny too, because there are things that you think about when you're making music and writing songs when you're like a little bit older versus 11 years young. And like, yeah, it gets loud. It's great. You know, and that's like all you need. Like, it's like, oh no, it's nice and loud. And then you're like, well,
yeah.
It actually sounds a little better if this is not exactly the same kind of loud on both sides, you know?
Yeah, I've played enough weirdo amps, you know, by accident or circumstance that I'm like, I really have gained an appreciation for my own shit.
It's good to have, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nice to, and again, it's nice to have a thing, right? And I feel like that goes very well with like the aesthetic that seemed to develop around you guys was just like, you know, like, look, this is like kick-ass heavy music. It isn't, you know, remedial woodshop. This is, but it isn't advanced, you know, particle physics either. And like it's somewhere in between, and you can have a good time with it. And you know, here it is. It sounds like this. Here we go. And I always appreciated the balance beam of walking that.
Yeah, I think some of our songs are, you know, if you want to deconstruct them or, you know, nerd out on like count things out or anything like that, there's some things that are like, I don't know, interesting, I guess. But yeah. But you don't have to listen to that. You don't have to listen to the music on that with that kind of scrutiny. I think the songs, as a something to turn up while you're doing the dishes, it totally works. But if you want to, but if you're a nerd like me, then there's extra shit going on.
Actually, the polyrhythm here is okay. Yeah. Yep.
Exactly. Right. I mean, I really, I love that crap. I love it.
Yeah, same.
You know, when we can sneak something in where it's like the drums are playing in three and the guitars are playing in four, but it doesn't sound wrong. It's just why it, you know, it sounds unique. It gives you, because yeah. I think that that's kind of the thing that my holy grail is having that sort of seasick feeling, which, you know, I don't know, becomes something else. You know, the interplay is what makes the thing. It's not the individual things. It's, you know, the juxtaposition of things which make which are like the fifth instrument or, you know, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. fifth Beatle or whatever. You know, I love that crap.
Oh, but yeah, juxtaposition. You don't know him? He was a Liverpool guy. Yeah.
Like, I still have yet to do it, but I really want to do one of those, a song. I'm not dead yet, so I'm going to do it. It's like the Disney movies, you know, where you'll have a theme and then it's like, I don't know, like Lady and the Tramp maybe has one where it's like the, you know, the tramp sings a song like, oh, I'm hungry, I'm in an alley. And then the fancy dog is like, ah, I'm so sad in my crystal castle. And then but then at the end, it's the same music, but then you've got the tramp and the lady singing both their parts and they work great together on top of each other. And you're like, yes!
Right, right. Oh, yeah, 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 totally.
I want to do that in my punk rock goth band.
Yeah, that's great. that's a great achievable goal. That's like, you know, when you have like specific stretch goals of like things you want to do in music or whatever, right? And I remember I was talking with a friend. I was like, yeah, I would love to have a song like the Phoebe Cates scene in Fast Times in Ridgemont High that has that car song. Like, I wanted that. Where it's like, you know, guys, especially of a certain age. Oh, yeah, I know that scene you're talking about. Yeah, that's yeah, that awesome song. Yeah, great. I want that. I want a song that like fits well with that. Great. That's awesome. That's
well, you know, if you have a certain slow-mo visual image to accompany things, you know, a lot of songs can really make an impact.
That's true. That's true. look at like what Trent Reznor's been up to with Atticus Ross, right? I mean, like, it's some of the things, it's like, oh yeah, all right. Like the tennis movie that came out was like, all right, so you're just really laying into the fact that you got Trent Reznor rocking the synths on this, huh? Okay, cool. Right on.
I haven't seen this thing. Although I'm a big fan of Trent Reznor. I think that there's a few albums that I was like, meh, I don't know, but I've followed Nine Inch Nails, and I think that, like, Hesitation Marks, I listened to that record, I was like, holy shit, man, this band still resonates with me.
He's got a really good handle on what he's trying to do and a real built world with it. And it's not surprising to me that he has done well with the soundtrack stuff, like Social Network and on. It's like, no, that makes sense if you think about what that guy does. But
yeah, he Trent resonates with me. You don't have to children have dad jokes.
There it is, everybody. There it is, everybody.
That's right.
So let's take it back a little bit. Tell me about Murder the Mountains. You know, a lot of it's crazy because you think about, like, I think, like, when people think of Chris Funk, they obviously think of your association with him. But at the time, it was like, the guy from the Decemberists? Like, what? Like, huh? Like, that doesn't make any sense yet. Can't argue with the results. How did that record come to pass?
He reached out to us, I think, like, well before we were probably still, probably hadn't even recorded our first record. And I think he reached out, and I think because Aaron was friendly with him, some connection maybe with Sarah, his ex-wife, and Sarah, I'm guessing it's something along those lines. But anyway, I think he might have mentioned it, and I was like, no, that's ridiculous. But, you know, I think he kept after us. I think he sent us a subsequent email or two, and we were, you know, getting set to put in our second record. And I was like, well, why? Well, let's meet the guy. I mean, he's the only one who seems to care. So let's talk to him. And so we met him at a bar, and he was surprisingly knowledgeable about our, music that we cared about and knew what he was talking about. And then we got in the studio with him, and he's a shredder, you know. I mean, he's known for being a folkster, but he knows his way around a guitar. He can actually play heavy, like fast guitar shit better than I can, certainly.
Well, and I think that also comes with, you know, sometimes you all have preconceptions of when somebody's known for doing a certain thing. It's like you think of, like, that's the thing that they do, and it's like, oh no, but they can do other things, especially when someone's a skilled musician. You know, it's kind of nice to, like, not have the preconceived notions, but especially for
And I think that, I mean, yeah, as far as like a PR thing, maybe it's a bad idea, but from just a completely, like, you know, working with creative individuals, he's a really creative guy. And I don't think that you should be restrained to your genre or whatever. It's like, these are like penalty boxes that are artificially created. So.
Well, and, you know, perhaps it was the timing, and perhaps it was the living in being a band for a little more time. But I feel like the jump up to Murder the Mountains from the first record, like, the songwriting wise, was just like, oh no, there's a lot more kind of happening here. There's a lot of kind of arrangement decisions and things that are being made. It's like, oh no, this is, yeah, this hits a little bit different, which it doesn't lose what makes it cool in the first place, but it hits a little different.
I remember we'd finished the basic tracks of that album, and then we were on tour, and he sent us a tape of the incidental shit that's happening in the breakdown and wires, and it was like, you know, it was like, I think I had a Halloween LP, you know, like spooky sounds, and I was like, what the fuck is this? But I was like, it's amazing. I love it. But it's like, it was so like, what are you doing? But I love it. So whatever.
Right. Well, and that's, you know, that's such a, and it's interesting what thing, when you first hear something, you're like, what? And then, you know, later on, like, well, I'm missing it. Where is it? I want to hear it again now. Where is it? You know, like, you become accustomed to it.
Yeah, it was just, that was the really, I think the coolest thing about working with him was that his ear was way, you know, was thinking way outside of where we were at. We're like, well, you know, what would Iron Maiden think of this? Who cares really what anybody thinks about it? But I mean, if we were trying to like get approval from anybody, it would be mostly people in the heavy metal world. And I think he was thinking way beyond just to like, what's good music in general.
Right. Which is good to have that perspective from like outside the band sometimes, to just be like, okay, where are we at? where are we at now? Where were we? What are we trying to do? And you know, the Rashomon effect, right? Of like making music, of like, it's all going to seem different for the people inside the band versus the people outside the band.
For sure. Yeah.
Well, and that's, so that's a good segue. Was the Orion Festival, the Metallica thing, right? Is that what the thing was called, right?
Orion Music and More.
Mm-hmm. It seemed to me, that was the one of the first times I'm like, oh, wow, Red Fang's doing that? That's crazy. That's awesome. And can you tell me a little bit about how that came to pass?
Well, we got an invitation to play it, I think probably through our booking agent, and it said curated by Metallica and the, you know, handpicked bands. And I was like, bullshit, man, there's no way. I was like, right, there's no way they got out of their golden hot tubs to pick a band. They're just doing this. And then we said, well, the only way I'm going to believe it is if they come to me and introduce themselves, and maybe I'll believe it. And then we went out there and spent the night in a really sketchy motel in New Jersey. We literally stepped over a body. I'm still not sure to this day if it was a dead person, but it was late at night. And I was like, look out for the body. And we all stepped over this body. And which is terrible. We should have maybe done something about it, but I was like, maybe he's probably on drugs and sleeping it off. That's what was happening.
That's the best case scenario in this situation.
Yeah, there were these like questionable bugs in the bed. Nobody slept in the bed. Like only three people slept in the hotel room with sleeping bags zipped up to their necks.
Oh yeah,
I think I handed out some Valium. I was like, all right, everybody, we're gonna get 3 hours of sleep in here. And anyway, but we got showed up the thing the next day, and right before we played our set, our manager was like, guys, get to stand here 10 minutes before set time. James Hetfield wants to meet you. And we're like, oh shit, you know, so we're all kind of freaking out. Anyway, so he did show up, and I sort of browned out the experience. I really don't remember it, except I know that I punched him. I remember that. Which is like, I don't know, it's like a fight or flight thing. I was like, oh my god,
what is it, one of those guys is just like, oh shit, it's that guy.
He's,
you know, like
a legend, man.
Yeah, it's like how many times, you know, like whatever, you know, the day in the life, blah blah blah, whatever that long convoluted title is. You just see him like, you know, tooling around, and you know, really a lot in what's it, Some Kind of Monster, right? Is it the real life Spinal Tap one?
Yeah. I can't believe they let that out.
Dude, it's so, I mean,
it's not, that's not what I would call a best foot forward, but whatever.
No. Well, and I used to characterize it as like, wow, it was really dumb that they did that. But then like when they did the record with Lou Reed, it's like, maybe it's brave. I don't know. It's like both at the same time, where it's like, yeah, this sounds like Grandpa Simpson, you know, singing over a guitar center, but like, okay, you know,
yeah,
good for you guys. You're you didn't need to do this. Like, this is good for you, you know?
Yeah, that was a long floodlight behind the curtain, you know? And so, so, I mean, it was ballsy. I'll give them that.
Yeah, yeah. They took a risk they didn't need to take, which, you know, Dave Mustaine never could. But all right, so you punch Hetfield. Great. Did you remember anything else about it?
Speaking about best foots forward, I don't know. But then we started playing, and he was side stage, and we started the first song, and I was like, huh, that sounds funny. And then it turned out that Aaron, I maybe did a last minute change in our set list, but he was tuned to drop D and the rest of us weren't. And he had to, over the course of the song, he tried to get his bass back up to E, but only made it to E flat. So he had to play.
Oh my God.
I know. It's not
this
good.
This is like an actual nightmare, right?
I know. I was like, well, our career is fucked and it hasn't even started.
I'm so sorry, but that's wow. Yeah.
And he may have left before we ever figured it out. So you might just think, well, those kids need to practice. That's probably
if they ever learn to tune their guitars, they might have something going.
Yeah, exactly. I'm gonna send those guys tuners for Christmas.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's horrific.
But what a cool festival that was. I mean, I think that day Hot Snakes played. Rocky Erickson played. I mean, it was like, and I think that a lot of the acts that they chose were really head scratchers for the majority of their fans.
Right, because it's not just
which
metal
I
fans.
Also, yeah, I really applaud them. It wasn't like they were doing well. Who worships, you know, Black Sabbath? Who worships our, you know, Metallica? And we're going to do a bunch of that, which they could have curated it in such a way that the, you know, metalheads, you know, have their perfect day. But that's not how they approached it. They were like, no, we have musical taste well outside of what we do, and we're going to bring it to the people. And so it was cool to be part of it and to be invited to do it. I mean, whatever. I mean, I probably wouldn't be in a band without Ride the Lightning. So
sure.
So it was cool. I mean, I'll remember that for the rest of my life for sure.
Yeah. I mean, like you gotta love any thing that has, like, I think Go-Go Bordello and Dillinger Escape Plan on the same bill. Great. You know, sounds good.
Yeah,
let's go.
It was wild. It was really cool.
Let's ride. No, I love that. I don't love that happened to you guys, but I love that. You know, I feel like, especially with a band of Metallica's profile, you only hear about when, oh, he was an asshole when he came in, and, you know, blah blah blah, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, oh, it's like they're doing things they do not have to do, and that's that speaks to their credit and their character.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, I think if you get to that point where, you know, you're the pinnacle of a genre or something like that, that you can say, no, we're gonna break the rules. You know, it's cool. And to their, maybe to their detriment.
Right. Like they, exactly. Yeah. They could just play it a little safer and maybe they'll have a little more mainstream success. Didn't they won a Grammy, right? They won a Grammy for for something. Didn't they?
Yeah, probably more than one.
Yeah. More than likely. I mean, that just shows how much I pay attention, but
yeah, that's not really a benchmark for people in our world.
Exactly. It's like, people are like, are you going to watch the Grammys? No. Why would I do that?
And even if you did, even if you did, the heavy metal section is never on TV. Yeah.
I didn't even watch it.
You're right next to like best coffee service at the studio. You know, it's like the credits rolling. You might be in there, whatever.
I was gonna say my tag for that is I didn't even watch it when a friend of mine won, which was John Congleton. Yeah.
There you go.
it was like my friend won and I didn't even bother watching. Of course
I won't tell
watch it. Yeah. Although I did say I take a crowbar to Jack White's knees if I need to before that. So credit where credit's due.
Oh,
I didn't have to.
Oh heavens.
Wires was another early Red Fang single plus killer Whitey video that also served the purpose of, much like Prehistoric Dog, just like, it looks like this band is having the best time that ever has been and you are welcome to come along to the ride. How was the filming for that video with the counter, the money counter?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, you know, when Whitey was like, all right, we're going to have you destroy shit with a car, I was like, oh, fuck, yeah. I don't even care if it makes it into a video. If we could just go out, spend the spring destroying things with a car, I don't care if it ever gets filmed. Let's just do it, you know.
So, yeah, it's just a good time.
It was really cool. I think the one thing that I like to bring up is that, you know, we smashed the milk in February, but it was overcast. So we got it. He got video of it, but the color, the lighting was off. So he was like, we need to do this again. And then we had to tour and he had jobs to do. So we didn't, we hit another wall of milk in May. Only we needed it to be consistent. So we, so we kept all the same clothes we were wearing and everything. And that car had sat with the milk on it for months. Anyway, so in February it was cold as shit. So we had the windows up and, it had to be the same. So we were wearing, heavy, like I was wearing a sweater, a flannel, a jacket and all this stuff in a car with the windows rolled up months later, it was now 80 degrees hotter in that car because the windows were up and there was rotten milk in it. It was gnarly.
That's amazing. That's like a worst case scenario, right?
It's what you do for art, man.
But hey, the results speak for themselves. It's like one of the greatest car antics in a music video that I've seen in our generation, for sure.
Yeah, it was as fun as it looked, that's for sure.
The prestige, as they call it, in the stage magic world. Good stuff. So tell me a little bit about moving on from that one over to Whales and Leeches. Was there a distinctive sort of like, hey, let's try something a little different? Or was it just like that's where you guys were at the time? Or what were you thinking with Whales?
No, I think it had a sophomore album feel because it was the first time we really felt a crunch because between the self-titled and Murder the Mountains, we really had as much time as we wanted. We didn't have a label, so we didn't have a home for it. So we just, it was at our leisure. Whereas Whales and Leeches, I think we were under a time crunch. Yeah. So, and I think that to some degree, I think that's why those songs are fast.
Yeah. I guess it makes sense, right? I mean, but there are a lot of fast bangers on there, and that's, not a bad thing at all. It's just,
there were a couple of, our attempts at speed metal.
Blood Like Cream, great single. That's a good representation of where the band was at the time. And I referenced it earlier, but one of the all-time kind of cool, wow, is this really happening moments? It was David Letterman. Letterman. Red Fang on cool. Fucking David Letterman.
I mean, I don't think it did a single thing for our career or whatever. I don't think anybody really cared. But it really made my mom happy. So
that is your parents understand what this is, level of notoriety for sure.
My mom's like, my mom went to a whole lot of our shows, in really kind of sketchy, did you get your shots kind of situations. And so to see us, on the TV was, I was like, oh, okay. I guess then that's they're not totally wasting their lives, but truthfully, when you look at like album sales or anything like that, we were interested to see how,
this is going to move the needle,
multi-million viewership or whatever. And it really didn't. What did, there was a show on MTV called like That Metal Show or something. And one of the hosts wore a Red Fang shirt and that made a marked increase in sales that week.
Really?
So yeah. Oh, so, okay. It's really, it's a niche market, but that's what matters is, people, in that world, more so than, cause we're not for wider consumption necessarily. I mean, I'm not that it's on purpose, but it's just, we're oddball enough that most people are like, no.
Well, that's something that, but that's something that made it so cool too, because it was characterized by a friend of mine as looking like a bunch of alley cats got led into the stage. And I was like, it was said with love, but I was like, no, I get it, because it's like you expect to see like, oh, here's the manicured, pop product, boy band or like whatever next big thing, playing some Anodyne thing that you forget about as you're listening to it. It's like, no, here's Red Fang on their freaking, you know, sons and like just gnarled, jacked up looking guitars, just, you know, pounding it out, so to speak.
It's yeah. Crazy. Well, I mean, my understanding was that, you know, David Letterman was, you know, his you know, talent buyer or whatever, you know, they were really into being the first, you know, they really liked to scour the corners and the dusty corners and find, you know, these bands that are, you know, off the beaten path. And so I think that was part of it, was like, I ain't nobody heard of this one. You know what I mean? It's like, here's your,
yeah,
here's your heavy duty curveball on Friday night, you know?
And good on them for doing that, because I think if more of those types of outlets put that kind of effort in, we might have a you know,
yeah, oh,
things,
yeah,
things might be a little better, right? Yeah,
I totally agree. I mean, I think that, you know, payola still exists, even at, like, you know, Spotify or Pandora. Those formats are still taking money from majors to say, hey, here's something that you might like. It's because someone paid them to tell you that.
Right, exactly.
So there's so many, you know, acts. I mean, back at, like, Saturday Night Live, when it started out, I mean, they had, like, Sun Ra on there, Devo.
Oh, yeah.
They're
Captain Beefheart.
Captain Beefheart, Frank Zappa, yeah. Just so many cool, weird things that definitely were not that, you know? This was counterculture, and the show had a counterculture attitude, there's just not money in it, I guess, so you just don't see it very often.
I can tell you there were a lot of people that generally don't care about that type of entertainment, I guess we'll call it, that were very stoked that evening, that night, that day, that, like, you know, a couple days afterwards, et cetera, et cetera. It was a nice thing to see. It felt like a win for the weirdos, if you will.
I'd like to think so.
So tell me about Only Ghosts. So how did you get mixed up with Ross Robinson? How did you come to be like, that's what we're gonna do? This is what the next record is. You mentioned Barisi, who I again can't speak highly enough myself. Tell me about where the band was at the time and why that decision.
Well, he came up to visit us. You know, we didn't know who we were going to work with, but he took the time and trouble to fly to Portland and sit down with us. And, you know, I mean, his pedigree was definitely not something that was, like, blowing my mind, you know, as far as Korn or, you know, what other acts that he worked on. I mean, we're super successful and very talented, just not my aesthetic.
Not a big Slipknot guy.
right, like Slipknot. They do put on a great show. I mean,
good
for
them.
Just doesn't really grab me, but their show is amazing.
You know,
it's
agree.
Just like, they like parkour and shit. It's insane. I they must go to the gym. It's crazy. I mean, like, diving off of shit. It's crazy.
Yeah. But there's also bands that's like, oh, that's a great live act, but you couldn't pay me to listen to them. And then there's also bands that, like, you know, like, oh, this band is makes great records, but they can't deliver it live or whatever. Or it's not to my sensibility. That's a better way to put it. I'm trying to be kinder.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, so I guess the thing with that was, like, well, you know, it's not going to inspire our fans, you know, like, oh, or get excited about us sounding like, you know, like Korn or whatever. But his belief in, like, his view on art and just, you know, the recording process and really getting to the core of whatever it is you're trying to do. That really spoke to us, and I was like, whatever, you know, it really won't do us favors. His previous successes aren't really going to help us, but
it's not really your world.
If anything, it's going to be blowback. But the thing was, meeting him, I was like, this guy is real deal. You know, he's passionate. He really cares. And he actually hears something in us that he wants to get out. And so I was like, well, I don't really care. I mean, it's the same thing with Chris Funk. Mm-hmm. That wasn't going to help us either, you know, but it's like, work right. You just want to work with people that are passionate about what they do. And it's not just a paycheck for them. And with both those guys, It was absolutely not a paycheck. If you know, if anything, it was an anti-paycheck. You know,
I mean, could have made more money doing something else. Sure, yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Their time is precious, and there's a lot of people knocking on their doors. So, you know, they're willing to take their time and make something hopefully that's beautiful. That's what, you know, that's so all of our choices are really boiled down to that. It's like, is this going to serve the music? You know.
Yeah, and it's also, it's where the band's at the time too, right? And you're not trying to all love to AC/DC, all love to the Ramones. You're not trying to do the same thing every time. You're trying to, you know, trying to do something different. You're growing, you're changing, you know, like, and sometimes it's like, well, let's try this.
Yeah, for sure. And we're still, you know, I'm still trying to grow musically. I recognize that I only have a few tricks in my bag. And so anytime I get a chance to play with someone new or to learn a fifth trick, you know, it's right. Great.
I think I uncharitably called myself the half trick pony at one point, which I kind of stand by as a clever.
You're at least one and a half tricks.
Yeah, exactly. Don't sell yourself short. You're a tremendous slouch. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, so take us into the COVID world of Red Fang, right? Like Arrows, how did Arrows come about? This was, there was a kind of a big break between records, right? It's like 4 years or something.
Yeah, it was, I think, longer than that. I think it was.
Was it longer?
2016 was only Ghost, and I think that came out in 22, so like 6 years. And that record was done.
Seems like last
during,
week.
During pandemic. And so for a while there, you know, it used to be like, oh, yeah, we toured with those guys. And then my story started being like, oh, we were supposed to tour with them. Oh, we were supposed to do this because we kept booking tours to like support the new record. And then pandemic continued and we're like, well, cancel that. And push back the release because we don't really want to release this thing without some kind of tour support. So we waited and waited and waited. And I was like, God help us. If this thing ever comes out, I'll be happy. And it did. So, but anyway.
So you go back to Chris, right? You know, you're making a record that's, you know, there's a little dirt on it in a good way. Like I said, I like it. That's like my second favorite. I think it's mean. You know, it's
yeah,
mean
some,
in a cool way.
There's some really cool weirdo things on it. You know,
yeah,
I'm happy with it.
Yeah, I think that. Yeah, I think it conducts itself well, and I think that it's something where there's a lot. Look, dude, a lot of records came out around that time, and you know, some of them were even good. But but I thought that was a great entry into the Red Fang pantheon, and I was like, oh wow, they're going kind of deep into this kind of just weirdo rock roots without really changing the intrinsic nature of what makes the band cool, but kind of just, you know, applying it in different ways. And I thought that was cool. That was a pretty bold, frankly.
Well, so I appreciate it.
That was there any kind of like any thought process to that? Well, you know, was it just like, let's just make a goddamn record so we can continue to move forward? Or was it more like, hey, let's do something specifically like a little more weirdo. Let's try to, you know, write songs more like this. Was there any kind of like mindset behind the creation of it? Because you had a lot of time to think about it, right?
No, I think I think that we're just, that's where our headspace was at, you know. And then maybe some of the weirder shit that got pushed aside. Some of those riffs were old, and that we just, you know, we're like, oh, that's too oddball. No one's gonna go for that. But then we're like, fuck it, let's make that a song and see what happens, you know. We've been like that. We've been a band for 15 years. It's like, well, let's have a little confidence. Let's just trust that that the majority of the people that have followed us thus far will continue to do so, you know. And And that record didn't fall on its face or anything. So, well, you know, I think it all worked out.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, yeah, like I said, I think it's a kick-ass record. And I think, honestly, you know what? That might have been when I had Aaron on. And I remember we did it in two parts for some reason. I don't remember why. But, like, that was like 4 years ago, right? I mean.
Yeah, 22.
Wow. That's jacked up.
I know. Well, time got a little weird with the pandemic. It just sort of like, it sort of was like the global pause button. And then you're like, did those years happen? You know, I mean, I think maybe I blacked it out a little bit, but I mean, that was no, a year and a half where I was like, the only way I got out of the house is walking a dog. My dog was ready for the Olympics. I mean, we were walking that dog like, I don't know, 8-10 miles a day.
Let's go. I'm a contender, kid. Let's go.
I know. My dog's like, I don't want to be an athlete. I said, yeah. Get out. Let's go.
We're doing it. We're doing it, kid. Yeah,
exactly.
I like that desk cover. Did you guys do? I was glad that was in the Deep Cuts record. That was cool. How did that come to pass? Was that just like here's an idea? Like,
I think that was John Sherman. I think he was a fan of that, and he would play that in the van and stuff. We're like, dude, that's crazy. And just how just the audacity for a 2-minute bass solo. Who does that? And then we're like,
bold,
well,
yeah.
And then, so and then I think Aaron was like, I'll do it, even though there's a bass solo. And he crushed it. That was great. But yeah, that's a little being put on the spot a little bit, but he raised to it and it was great.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's one of the nice things about this Deep Cuts thing too, is it kind of shows more that like kind of a reverent spirit of the band where it's like, all right, sure. Let's give this, you know, let's give this a shot. Let's try this. And it sounds like a band that's very sure of itself in a good way. Instead of like a band that's sure of itself in a bad way, if you know what I mean.
Well, it's a great song. I mean, you know, I don't know if we improved upon it, but I think we did it justice.
Yeah, absolutely. So you said it's not really your thing to have like the B-sides, the odds and sods, non-album cuts, et cetera, et cetera. It's not really your deal. Was there any stuff that was left out? Was there any stuff that you were like, nah, not that?
Well, one song that got left out, I don't know how it got left out, but I'm sad about is Will from Dialect did a remix for us of what song is it? It's the first song on the record, and he did a remix of that. And it's crazy. It's super dark goth, and the chunks that he took out of the song and reworked are so mutated that you can't even tell it's that song. It's but I thing. Love it. But yeah. Anyway, he worked hard on that, and I don't know if the response from the other guys wasn't great, or I don't know why, but that song definitely should have been on this thing. And so that's my one great regret, is that that's not on there.
That's too bad. Yeah, Will's a badass.
We'll release it. We'll release these. Yeah, Will is amazing. You know.
Yeah.
His, you know, Dialect's been, compared. It has been described as the Black Sabbath of hip hop. You know, and sure, for good reason. What a great band. So, anyway, so other than that, I mean, you know, I think we got everything that we wanted to put in there. I mean, to the point. You know, we did the math wrong, or somebody did the math wrong, but we couldn't fit it all on one LP. And they're like, do you want to drop some songs, or do you want to make it a double LP? And I was like, well, you guys want to spend money on a double LP? And so the label was willing to do it. And I was like, all right, don't drop anything. Let's put it all on there. And I'm really glad because I don't think there's a weak spot on it. I think one thing leads to the next in a real nice way.
Well, absolutely. And it's something where, you know, it all sits nicely together, even stuff that's like, you know, very clearly like demos or like, you know, let's go ahead and say varying levels of studio magic recording quality. It all sits very nicely. Like, it's good. Like, it's, you know, it shows, it tells a story that's kind of like the sensibility of the band and sort of you know, taking things seriously, but also not taking things too seriously sometimes. And I appreciate that because I think sometimes artists can get, you know, a little bit too high in their own supply, if you know what I mean. And
it's right. Well, you know, we had a string section on the last record, so I think that's about as high and mighty as we'll ever get.
Is there so of the many, many songs, there's like 26 in all. Is there one that you're like, yeah, man, that's the one. I'm glad that's out there. Like, you're really excited for people to hear it, or you're really like rediscovered it or have some special affinity for it.
Oh, geez. I don't know. I mean, a lot of those songs are like, oh yeah, I remember this. Like I have fond memories of them, and to have them see the light of day in a way, because some of them, you know, they all got released or were accessible one way or another, except for the demos, yeah. And the home recordings. But, you know, but they're hard to find. And so it's cool that these songs are actually getting a little bit, you know, some of the attention that they were due, I think. So
they get their day on the side.
I think that probably the song that I'm most proud of is OMG, OMD. Because I've always wanted to be like, you know, a spooky goth guy, so that was my shot at it.
You get your one bullet in the chamber for it, right?
Yeah, it was. I was like, I can't believe that the other guys in the band are willing to put this on there, you know.
Yeah, that's great. That's awesome. Love it, Brian. It's been so great talking to you, man. Thanks for coming on, talking about the record, talking about all things Red Fang. It's a pleasure. Love the band, love what you do. Anything, what's coming up? Anything coming up?
No, I'm working on a solo project right now. So hopefully that'll be out in the world turn of next year. That's my goal.
We should come back for it. Come back and we'll talk.
Okay. Yeah. All right. If you're willing to have me.
Don't threaten me with a good time, baby. Let's go.
I love to talk, so all right.
Brian, it's been great having you. Yeah, thanks so much for being so giving of your time. Last question. This is the only canned question that I ever ask, so you can choose to interpret it however you like.
Hit me.
And it is this. Why do you do what you do?
Because I have to. No, it's what gets me out of bed. I think it's a fear of death is what I think it is, what it comes down to. It's like, if you know, you want to leave your mark so that, you know, you're not totally dust in the wind, you know. I mean, we all are anyway, but it's sort of, it's helpful to think that, oh no, I'm going to make this thing. And then at least for a couple years after I croak, they'll people be like, oh yeah, I remember that guy. So I guess it's that.
Brian Giles, thanks so much, sir. Appreciate you.
Hey, thanks for having me. I had a good time.
Awesome. Until next time, all right?
Yes, sir.
All right, take care, brother.
Buongiorno.
There goes Brian Giles, Red Fang, Party Time, Last the Juanitas. Cool guy. You heard him. He committed to being on the show again when he does the solo record. So let's hear something off of the Deep Cuts record, which is available now at redfang.bandcamp.com. As well as through all the your finer record place guys. Sure, we're going to work on that. This is Over the Edge.
Don't need
All right, Over the Edge, Wipers cover, Red Fang. It's off of Deep Cuts. You can get that redfang.bandcamp.com. It's on vinyl, compact disc, hat. Well, it's not on the hat, but you can get it. You can get a hat. Yeah, hey, it's Ryan Giles. Pretty cool guy. Could have nerded out about Last One Need Us for Forever. But that's how you know that it's a more adult show, because I know that only me and five other people care about that. Great dude. Great dude. Thank you very much for listening to Code New Touch Protonic Reversal. Thank you so very much. Deeply appreciated. Deeply appreciated. The show airs Thursdays, 8 Eastern, 7 Central, 6 Mountain, 5 Pacific. Streaming live on YouTube. Podcast later everywhere for free. ProtonicReversal.com for the archives. Always free. No ads, no sponsors. No kidding. But if you like the show and you want to get episodes sooner, $1 a month at patreon.com/protonicreversal. Gladly achieves that goal. Helps keep the lights on this joint, too. So appreciate it for that, too. Thanks, folks, for liking, subscribing, sharing around. All that helps people discover the show. That's lovely as well. Anyone within the sound of my voice. Going to be a few week break here. For Protonic, Code Neutron, The Secret Friends, new record, Way of the Neutron, out now, neutronfriends.bandcamp.com. Sorry, not sorry, I'm going to be touring Japan, so that's cool. But stay tuned, there's a bunch of cool stuff in late April and early May before we go out and tour again for the U.S., pay attention. I've been told I don't talk about the band enough. I feel like I talk about the band plenty. Whatever. That's it. Stay safe out there, boppers.
Out on Route 128, dark and lonely. I got my radio on. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? To my top 10. I'd like to thank our sponsor. But we haven't got a sponsor. Not if you were the last man on earth. She was prepared to prove it. This one goes out to a special girl. There is no special girl! It's the end of radio! The last announcer plays the last record! The last what? Leaves the transmitter! Circles the globe in search of a listener.
Is it really broadcasting if there's no one there to receive? It's the end of radio. As we come to the close of our broadcast day, radio. Can you hear me now? Hey, hey!